but White recognized them, Hale and Ramsey. "Why, hello, Tom," Hale said to White.
"Hello, Bill," White answered.
Ramsey said to White,
"Howdy."
White shook hands with both inmates, who were then led away to their cells. 21. The Hothouse. It was like wandering through the catacombs of memory. As White walked along the cell block tiers, he could see figures from his past, their eyes peering out from behind bars, their bodies gleaming with sweat. He saw Hale and Ramsey. He encountered members of the old Al Spencer gang and the former head of the Veterans Bureau who had committed bribery during the scandalous Harding administration. And White came upon the two deserters who had killed his older brother Dudley, though White never mentioned the connection, not wanting to cause them any distress. White lived with his family on the prison grounds. His wife was initially unable to sleep, wondering, how do you raise two young boys in this kind of environment? The challenges of managing the prison, which was designed to hold 1,200 inmates but instead had three times that number, were overwhelming. In the summer, the temperatures inside rose as high as 115 degrees, which is why prisoners would later call Leavenworth the hothouse. One August day in 1929, when it was so nightmarishly hot that the milk in the prison's kitchen soured, a riot erupted in the mess hall. Red Rudinsky, an infamous safecracker, recalled that there was ugly, dangerous, killing hate, and that White rushed in to quell the unrest. "Warden White showed his courage and came within a few feet of me, although cleavers and broken, jagged bottles were inches from him." White tried to improve conditions in the prison. A custodian who later worked under him recalled, "The warden was strict with the inmates, but would never stand for any mistreatment or heckling of them." White once sent Rudinsky a note that said, "It takes a good deal of nerve to change a course that you have been on for years and years. More so, maybe, than I realize. But if it is in you, now is the time to show it." Because of White's support, Rudinsky recalled, "I had a ray of hope." Though White encouraged efforts at rehabilitation, he had few illusions about many of the men contained in the hothouse. In 1929, Carl Panzram, a repeat killer who'd confessed to slaying 21 people and insisted, "I have no conscience," beat a member of the prison staff to death. He was sentenced to be hanged inside the penitentiary, and White, though opposed to capital punishment, was given the grim task of overseeing the execution, much as his father had done in Texas. On September 5th, 1930, as the sun rose over the prison dome, White went to take Panzram from his cell to the newly built gallows. White made sure that his two boys weren't present when the noose was looped around the neck of Panzram, who shouted at his executioners to hurry up, "I could hang a dozen men while you're fooling around." At 6:03 a.m., the trap opened, and Panzram swung to his death. It was the first time that White had helped to end a human life. After arriving at Leavenworth, William Hale was assigned to duty on the tuberculosis ward. Later, he toiled on the prison farm, where he tended pigs and other animals the way he had during his early days on the frontier. A prison report said, "He does high-grade work caring for stock, and is able to do such operations as opening of abscesses and castrating of animals." In November 1926, when a reporter wrote to White fishing for gossip about Hale, White refused to provide any, insisting that Hale would be treated as other prisoners are treated. White went out of his way so that Hale's wife and daughter never felt slighted by prison officials. Hale's wife once wrote a letter to White saying, "Would I be imposing to ask your permission to see my husband next Monday? It will be almost 3 weeks since my last visit, and of course I realize your regulations allow us only one visit each month, but if you could please grant me this, I would surely appreciate it." White wrote back that she would be welcome at the prison. Over the years, Hale never admitted ordering any of the murders.
Not the killing of Roan, for which he was convicted, or the countless other murders that the evidence showed he had orchestrated, but that he wasn't prosecuted for after he had received a life sentence. Despite his refusal to admit responsibility, he had given, during trial testimony, a rather cold statement about a different attempt that he'd made to swindle a head right, a statement that seemed to reveal his ethos. It was a business proposition with me. Whereas White had once turned to preachers to illuminate this thing of darkness, he now also searched for a scientific explanation. In prison, Hale was given a neurological and psychological examination. The evaluator found that Hale showed no obvious evidence of repression nor of frank psychosis, but nevertheless had extremely vicious components in his makeup. Cloaking his savagery under the banner of civilization, Hale portrayed himself as an American pioneer who had helped forge a nation out of the raw wilderness. The evaluator observed, "His poor judgment is further evidenced by his continued denial of his obvious guilt. His affect is not suitable. He has put behind him any feeling of shame or repentance he may have had." White read the evaluator's psychological study of Hale, but there was some evil that seemed beyond the scope of science. Though Hale conformed to prison regulations, he continued to scheme to secure his release. He allegedly arranged for an appeals court to be bribed, and when these efforts failed to win him freedom, he boasted, as the evaluator noted, of his probable release through influence of friends. Yet for the first time in ages, life in Osage County went on without his overwhelming presence. Molly Burkhart began again to socialize and attend church. She eventually fell in love with a man named John Cobb, who was part white and part Creek. According to relatives, their love was genuine, and in 1928 they were married. There was another dramatic change in Molly's life. She and the Osage had fought to end the corrupt system of guardianships, and on April 21, 1931, a court ruled that Molly was no longer a ward of the state. It is further ordered, adjudged, and decreed by the court that the said Molly Burkhart, Osage Alati number 285, is hereby restored to competency, and the order heretofore made adjudging her to be an incompetent person is hereby vacated. At 44, Molly could finally spend her money as she pleased and was recognized as a full-fledged American citizen. On December 11, 1931, White was in his warden's office when he heard a noise. He stood and went to the door and found himself staring into the barrel of a gun. Seven of the most dangerous convicts, including two Al Spencer gang members and a bandit who was nicknamed Boxcar because of his giant size, were attempting to escape. The group was armed with a Winchester rifle, a sawed-off shotgun, and six sticks of dynamite which had been smuggled into the prison. The convicts took White and eight members of his staff hostage and used them as shields as they pushed forward. Once outside the front gate, the prisoners released the other hostages and headed out to the main road with White, their insurance policy, as they called him. The inmates commandeered an approaching vehicle, forced White inside, and sped away. White's captors reminded him that there'd be nothing left of him to bury if anything went wrong. Everything was going wrong. The car slipped off the muddy road and got stuck, forcing the prisoners to flee on foot. Soldiers from Fort Leavenworth joined the manhunt. Planes were flying overhead. The inmates ran into a farmhouse and seized an 18-year-old girl and her younger brother. White pleaded with the prisoners, saying, "I know you're going to kill me, but don't kill these two. They aren't in it at all." Boxcar and another inmate went to look for a second car, taking White with them. At one point, White could see that the girl had broken free and was running. The gang seemed ready to start killing, and White grabbed the barrel of the gun being held by one of his captors, who yelled at Boxcar, "Shoot him! He's got my gun!" As Boxcar leveled his shotgun at White's chest only inches away, White lifted his left forearm to shield himself. Then he heard the blast and felt the bullet boring through his arm, through flesh and blood and bone, the buckshot fragmenting, some pieces going through his arm and into his chest. Yet White was standing. It was like a miracle. He had been shot to pieces, and yet he was still breathing in the cold December air. And then he felt the butt of the rifle smashing into his face, and he crumbled, all 225 pounds of him, and fell into a ditch, bleeding out and left to die. Nearly a decade later, in December 1939, the acclaimed newspaper reporter Ernie Pyle stopped at Latuna Prison near El Paso, Texas. He asked to meet the warden and was led in to see Tom White, who was then nearly 60 years old. "White asked me to stay for lunch," Pyle later wrote, "so I did, and we sat and talked, and finally he told me the story, as I was hoping all the time he would, the story about his left arm." White described how, after being shot by Boxcar, he was found in the ditch and rushed to the hospital. For several days it was uncertain whether he would live, and doctors contemplated amputating his arm. But he survived somehow, and he even kept his arm, though it still had bullet fragments lodged inside and dangled uselessly. White didn't mention one detail to Pyle. The girl who had been taken hostage credited White with protecting her and her brother. "I am sure they intended to kill all of us, and only Warden White's bravery saved us," she said. None of the convicts managed to get away. They believed that if you touched a prison official, especially a warden, it was better, as one of them remarked, never to come back, because if you do, you're going to have a hard, hard time. And so when the authorities caught up with Boxcar and the other escapees, Boxcar shot his two companions, then put a bullet in his own forehead. The other inmates prepared to kill themselves by detonating the dynamite, but before they could light the fuse, they were apprehended. One of them said, "The funny part is that when we got back to the institution, they never laid a hand on us. Warden White was a hell of a man. He left strict orders. No hands on these people. Leave them alone. Treat them just like the rest of the prisoners," he added. "Otherwise, we'd have got our heads broken in." White learned that Rudinsky had been recruited to assist with the escape, but had refused. He had begun to develop a sense of responsibility, White told another writer. He realized that I had been fair with him, and was sincerely trying to help him establish himself as a member of legitimate society. In 1944, Rudinsky was released on parole and had a successful career as an author and a businessman. When White had sufficiently recovered, he took over as warden of Latuna, a job that was less strenuous. Pyle wrote of the shooting, "The experience affected Warden White as it would anyone. It didn't make him afraid, but it made him jumpy and kind of haunted." Pyle continued, "I don't see how, after an experience like that, you could look upon any convict with anything but hatred. But Warden White isn't that way. He is thoroughly professional about his job. He is a serious, pleasant man, and he has trained himself to control his emotions." If J. Edgar Hoover used the Osage murder probe as a showcase for the Bureau, a series of sensational crimes in the 1930s stoked public fears and enabled Hoover to turn the organization into the powerful force recognized today. These crimes included the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's baby and the Kansas City Massacre, where several lawmen were killed in a shootout while transporting the Al Spencer gang member Frank Jelly Nash. White's old colleague, Agent Frank Smith, was among the convoy but survived. The journalist Robert Unger later documented how Smith and another agent, who originally claimed that they hadn't been able to identify the shooters, suddenly vividly recalled them after pressure from Hoover to resolve the cases. In the wake of these incidents, Congress passed a series of New Deal reforms that gave the federal government its first comprehensive criminal code and the Bureau a sweeping mission. Agents were now empowered to make arrests and carry firearms, and the department was soon renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation. "The days of the small bureau were over," Hoover's biographer Kurt Gentry observed. Gone, too, were the days when special agents were merely investigators.
White's brother Doc was involved in many of the Bureau's biggest cases during this period, from hunting public enemies like John Dillinger to killing Ma Barker and her son Fred. Tom White's son had also joined the Bureau, making three generations of white lawmen. Hoover ensured that the identity of the Bureau was indistinguishable from his own, and while presidents came and went, this bureaucrat, now thick around the waist and with jowls like a bulldog, remained. I looked up, and there was J. Edgar Hoover on his balcony, high and distant and quiet, watching with his misty kingdom behind him, going on from president to president and decade to decade, a reporter for Life magazine wrote. The many details of Hoover's abuses of power would not be made public until after his death in 1972. And despite White's perceptiveness, he was blind to the boss man's megalomania, his politicization of the Bureau, and his paranoid plots against an ever-growing list of perceived enemies, among them American Indian activists. Over the years, White wrote periodically to Hoover. Once White invited him to a relative's ranch. We do not have to rough it on his ranch, for he has every convenience except air cooling, and you don't need that. But Hoover politely declined. He was too busy now and had to be prodded to take note of his former star agent. When White, at the age of 70, stepped down as warden of Latuna in 1951, Hoover sent him a card only after another agent reminded him how much White would appreciate a personal note from the director on his retirement. In the late 1950s, White learned that Hollywood was about to shoot a movie, the FBI story starring James Stewart as a crime-busting agent that would feature a segment on the murders of the Osage. White sent Hoover a letter asking if the filmmakers might want to talk to him about the case. I would be glad to afford the information as I know it from start to finish, White said. Hoover replied that he would certainly bear you in mind, but he never followed up. Hoover made a cameo appearance in the 1959 movie, which further enshrined him in the popular imagination. But even though the movie was popular, the Osage case was fading from memory, eclipsed by more recent celebrated cases. Soon most Americans had forgotten it. In the late 1950s, White contemplated writing a story to document the case. He wanted to record the crimes against the Osage and wanted to make sure that the agents who had worked with him were not erased from history. They had all since died in obscurity and often in poverty. When one of the undercover operatives was dying, his wife wrote that she wished he had a retirement fund. And an agent who knew him advised Hoover that the family was confronted with a very gloomy situation. Several years after the Osage murder investigation, Wren, the Ute agent, was forced out of the Bureau again, this time for good. As he left, he cursed and threw items from his desk. His treatment, he later wrote to Hoover, had been unjust, unfair, and unwarranted. Wren's anger eventually dissipated. And before he died in 1939, he sent Hoover a letter that said, "Often when I read of you and your men, I swell up with much pleasure and pride. Then I begin to think again of the long time ago. I am very proud of you and still call you my old chief." He continued, "Many of my old friends have gone to the happy hunting grounds. Many of the tall, beautiful trees have been destroyed. Many have been cut down by the white man. The wild turkey, the deer, the wild horses, and the wild cattle have gone and do not live any more among the beautiful hills." Along with documenting the roles of other agents, White no doubt hoped to secure himself a small place in history, though he'd never say so himself. He wrote a few stilted pages which read in part, "After the director, Mr. J. Edgar Hoover, briefed me on the importance of the case, he instructed me to return to Houston, arrange my affairs there, and go as soon as possible to take charge of the Oklahoma City office. He told me I was to select my investigators necessary in this case from men I knew best fitted in this line of work.
We realized the importance of men working undercover more than ever when we arrived on the ground and found the frightened state of mind the Indians were living under. White recognized that he wasn't much of a writer, and by 1958 he had teamed up with Fred Grove, an author of Western novels who was part Osage and who, as a boy, had been staying in Fairfax at the time of the Smith explosion, an event that haunted him. As Grove worked on the book, White asked him in a letter if the narrative could be told in the third person. "I would like to keep the big I out of it all I can, because I don't want it conveyed that I am the whole story," White explained. "If it had not been for the good agents I had on the job, we could never have made it. Then, too, our boss man, J. Edgar Hoover, the directing head of the FBI, is to be reckoned with." In a letter to Hoover, White asked if the Bureau would release to him some of the old case files to help him prepare the book. He also inquired whether Hoover would write a brief introduction. "I hope this will not be asking too much of you," White said. "I feel that this would be invaluable to us all who were then and are now vitally interested in our great organization, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You and I are about the only ones of the originals left now." In an internal memo, Clyde Tolson, the associate director of the Bureau who had become Hoover's longtime companion, spawning rumors that they were romantically involved, said, "We should furnish only limited routine material, if any." White's body was beginning to fail him. He had arthritis. He tripped walking, and injured himself. In September 1959, White's wife told Grove, "Sickness of any kind is really very terrible to him, and puts him out considerably. We still hope he will improve, so that he can go to Dallas the last of October to attend the National Convention of Ex-FBI Agents." Even in his ailing state, White assisted Grove with the book, as if he were consumed by an unsolved case, until the manuscript was completed. In a letter to Grove, White wrote, "I am hoping that all the good luck in the world will come our way from a good publisher," adding that he would be keeping his fingers crossed. But publishers found the account less than captivating, and though Grove would eventually release a fictionalized version called The Years of Fear, the original historical account was never published. "I am sincerely sorry this letter couldn't bring better news," an editor said. On February 11th, 1969, Doc, who was staying on the ranch where he and Tom had grown up, died at the age of 84. In a letter, White shared the news with Hoover, noting that he and his four siblings had been born on this land. He added wistfully, "And now I am the only one left." In October 1971, White collapsed from an apparent stroke. He was 90 and had no more miraculous escapes. On December 21st, in the early morning hours, he stopped breathing. A friend said, "He died as he had lived, quietly and with a calm dignity." An agent urged Hoover to send condolences to White's widow, emphasizing that there was nothing in White's files to militate against such action. And so Hoover sent a bouquet of flowers, which was laid upon the casket as it disappeared into the ground. For a moment, before he receded from history too, White was eulogized as a good man who had solved the murders of the Osage. Years later, the Bureau would release several of its files on the Osage investigation in order to preserve the case in the nation's memory. But there was something essential that wasn't included in these and other historical records, something that White himself had missed. There was another layer to the case, a deeper, darker, even more terrifying conspiracy, which the Bureau had never exposed.
Chronicle 3, The Reporter. We have a few old mouth-to-mouth tales. We exhume from old trunks and boxes and drawers letters without salutation or signature, in which men and women who once lived and breathed are now merely initials or nicknames out of some now incomprehensible affection which sound to us like Sanskrit or Choctaw. We see dimly people the people in whose living blood and seed we ourselves lay dormant and waiting, in this shadowy attenuation of time, possessing now heroic proportions, performing their acts of simple passion and simple violence, impervious to time and inexplicable. William Faulkner, Absalom, Absalom. 22. Ghostlands. So much is gone now. Gone are the big petroleum companies and the forests of derricks, as the vast oil fields have been increasingly depleted. Gone is the million-dollar elm. Gone are the railroads, including where Al Spencer and his gang pulled off the last train robbery in Oklahoma in 1923. Gone, too, are the outlaws, many of whom died as spectacularly as they lived. And gone are virtually all the boom towns that smoldered from morning until night. Little remains of them but shuttered buildings colonized by bats and rodents and pigeons and spiders. While in the case of Whizbang there is nothing save stone ruins submerged in a sea of grass. Several years ago, a longtime resident of one of the boom towns lamented, "Stores gone, post office gone, train gone, school gone, oil gone, boys and girls gone. Only thing not gone is graveyard, and it get bigger." Pawhuska is filled with its share of abandoned buildings, but it is one of the few towns that remain. It has a population of 3,600. It has schools, a courthouse, the same one where Ernest Burkhart was tried, and several restaurants, including a McDonald's. And Pawhuska is still the capital of the vibrant Osage Nation, which in 2006 ratified a new constitution. The nation maintains its own elected government and has 20,000 members. The majority are scattered in other parts of the state or the country, but around 4,000 reside in Osage County, above the underground reservation. The Osage historian Lewis F. Burns observed that after only shreds and tatters remained of his people, they had risen from the ashes of their past. One summer day in 2012, after traveling from New York, where I live and work as a reporter, I visited Pawhuska for the first time, hoping to find information on the Osage murder cases, which by then were nearly a century old. Like most Americans, when I was in school, I never read about the murders in any books. It was as if these crimes had been excised from history. So when I stumbled upon a reference to the murders, I began to look into them. Since then, I had been consumed with trying to resolve lingering questions to fill in the gaps in the FBI's investigation. In Pawhuska, I stopped at the Osage Nation Museum, where I had arranged to meet with its longtime director, Catherine Redcorn. A woman in her 70s, with a broad face and short graying hair, she had a gentle, scholarly manner that masked an inner intensity. She showed me an exhibit of photographs of many of the 2,229 allotted members of the tribe, including several of her relatives, who had each received a headright in 1906. In one of the display cases, I spotted a photograph of Molly Burkhart sitting happily with her sisters. Another photograph showed their mother, Lizzie. And everywhere I turned while touring the exhibit, I recognized another victim of the Reign of Terror. Here, a young striking George Bigheart in a cowboy hat. There, Henry Roan with his long braids. Over there, a dashing Charles Whitehorn wearing a suit and bow tie. The most dramatic photograph in the museum spanned an entire side of the room. Taken at a ceremony in 1924, it was a panoramic view of members of the tribe alongside prominent local white businessmen and leaders. As I scanned the picture, I noticed that a section was missing, as if someone had taken a scissors to it. I asked Redcorn what happened to that part of the photograph. "It's too painful to show," she said. When I asked why, she pointed to the blank space and said, "The devil was standing right there." She disappeared for a moment, then returned with a small, slightly blurred print of the missing panel. It showed William K. Hale staring coldly at the camera. The Osage had removed his image, not to forget the murders, as most Americans had, but because they cannot forget. A few years ago, Redcorn told me, she was at a party in Bartlesville, and a man approached her. He said that he had Anna Brown's skull, she recalled. It was evidently the part of Brown's skull that the undertaker had kept in 1921, and given to Bureau agents for analysis. Outraged, Redcorn told the man, "That needs to be buried here." She called the Osage chief, and Anna's skull was retrieved and at a quiet ceremony interred with her other remains. Redcorn gave me the names of several Osage who she thought might have information about the murders, and she promised to later share with me a related story about her grandfather. "It's hard for us to talk about what happened during the Reign of Terror," she explained. "So many Osage lost a mother or a father or a sister or a brother or a cousin. That pain never goes away." Over several weekends each June, the Osage hold their ceremonial dances in Launchka. These dances, which take place at different times in Hominy, Pawhuska, and Grey Horse, three areas where the Osage first settled when they came to the reservation in the 1870s, help preserve fading traditions and bind the community together. The Osage come from all over to attend the dances, which provide a chance to see old family and friends and cook out and reminisce. The historian Burns once wrote, "To believe that the Osages survived intact from their ordeal is a delusion of the mind. What has been possible to salvage has been saved, and is dearer to our hearts because it survived. What is gone is treasured because it was what we once were. We gather our past and present into the depths of our being and face tomorrow. We are still Osage. We live and we reach old age for our forefathers." During a subsequent visit to the region, I headed to Grey Horse to see the dances and meet one of the people Redcorn had suggested I find, someone who had been profoundly affected by the murders. Almost nothing remained of the original Grey Horse settlement, but some rotted beams and bricks buried in the wild grasses, which the wind ruffled in ghostly rhythms. To accommodate the dances, the Osage had erected amid the encroaching wilderness a pavilion, with a mushroom-shaped metal roof and a circular earth floor surrounded by concentric rows of wooden benches. When I arrived on a Saturday afternoon, the pavilion was crowded with people. Gathered in the center, around a sacred drum used to commune with Wakonta, were several male musicians and singers. Ringed around them were the lady singers, as they are called, and in a circle farther out were dozens of male dancers, young and old, wearing leggings, brightly colored ribbon shirts, and bands of bells below their knees. Each of these dancers had on a headdress, typically made of an eagle feather, porcupine quills, and a deer tail, which stood up like a mohawk. At the sound of the drumming and singing, these dancers stepped in a counterclockwise circle to commemorate the rotation of the earth, their feet pounding the soft earth, their bells jangling. As the drumming and choral singing intensified, they crouched slightly and stepped more quickly, moving together with precision. One man nodded his head, while another flapped his arms like an eagle. Others gestured as if they were scouting or hunting. There was a time when women were not allowed to dance at these events, but they now joined in as well. Wearing blouses and broadcloth skirts and hand-woven belts, they formed a slower-moving, dignified circle around the male dancers, keeping their torsos and heads straight as they bobbed up and down with each step. Many Osage looked on from the benches, fanning themselves in the heat. A few stole glances at cell phones, but most watched reverently. Each bench bore the name of an Osage family, and as I walked around to the southern side of the pavilion, I found the one I was looking for, Burkhart. Before long, an Osage woman walked toward me. In her early 50s, she wore a powder blue dress and stylish glasses, and her long black glossy hair was pulled back in a ponytail. Her expressive face seemed vaguely recognizable. "Hi, I'm Margie Burkhart," she said, extending her hand. Margie is the granddaughter of Molly Burkhart. She serves on a board that directs healthcare services for the Osage, and she had driven from her home in Tahlequah, 70 miles southeast of Tulsa, to the dances with her husband, Andrew Lowe, a Creek Seminole. The three of us sat on the wooden bench, and while watching the dancers, spoke about Margie's family. Her father, now deceased, was James Cowboy Burkhart, the son of Molly and Ernest Burkhart. Cowboy and his sister Elizabeth, also now dead, had witnessed the reign of terror from inside their father's house of secrets. Margie said of Ernest, "He took away everything from my dad, his aunts, his cousins, his trust." Though Cowboy was haunted by the knowledge of what Ernest had done, he adored Molly. "He always spoke fondly of her," Margie recalled. "When he was little, he'd get these real bad earaches, and he said she'd blow in his ears to make the pain go away." After Molly divorced Ernest, she lived with her new husband, John Cobb, on the reservation. Margie was told that it had been a good marriage, a period of happiness for her grandmother. On June 16, 1937, Molly died. The death, which wasn't considered suspicious, received little notice in the press. The Fairfax chief published a short obituary. "Mrs. Molly Cobb, 50 years of age, passed away at 11 o'clock Wednesday night at her home. She had been ill for some time. She was a full-blood Osage." Later that year, Ernest Burkhart was paroled. The Osage Tribal Council issued a resolution protesting that anyone convicted of such vicious and barbarous crimes should not be freed to return to the scene of these crimes. The Kansas City Times, in an editorial, said, "The parole of Ernest Burkhart from the Oklahoma State Penitentiary recalls what was possibly the most remarkable murder case in the history of the Southwest, the wholesale slaying of Osage Indians for their oil head rights. The freeing of a principal in so cold-blooded a plot, after serving little more than a decade of a life sentence, seems to reveal one of the besetting weaknesses of the parole system." Margie said that after Ernest got out, he robbed an Osage home and was sent back to prison. In 1947, while Ernest was still in jail, Hale was released, having served 20 years at Leavenworth. Parole board officials maintained that their ruling was based on the grounds of Hale's advanced age, he was 72, and his record as a good prisoner. An Osage leader said that Hale should have been hanged for his crimes, and members of the tribe were convinced that the board's decision was the last vestige of Hale's political influence. He was forbidden to set foot again in Oklahoma, but according to relatives, he once visited them and said, "If that damn Ernest had kept his mouth shut, we'd be rich today." Margie told me that she never met Hale, who died in 1962, in an Arizona nursing home. But she saw Ernest after he got out of prison again in 1959. Barred from returning to Oklahoma, he had initially gone to work on a sheep farm in New Mexico, earning $75 a month. A reporter noted at the time, "It will be a far cry from the days of affluence as the husband of an oil-rich Osage Indian woman." In 1966, hoping to return to Oklahoma, Ernest applied for a pardon. The records no longer exist, but his appeal, which went before a 5-member review board in Oklahoma, was based at least partly on his cooperation with the Bureau's investigation of the murders. White had always credited Burkhart's confession as salvaging his case. Despite intense protests from the Osage, the board ruled 3-2 in favor of a pardon, which the governor then granted. "Headright's killer wins pardon vote," the Oklahoman declared, adding, Osages terrorized. Stooped and with thinning hair, Ernest went back to Osage County, where at first he stayed with his brother Brian. When I met Ernest, I had just become a teenager, Margie recalled. I was very surprised he looked so grandfatherly. He was very slight with graying hair. His eyes looked so kind. He wasn't rough, even after all those years in prison. And I couldn't fathom that this man had done all that. Her voice trailed off amid the insistent beating of the drum. After a while, she continued, "It was so hard on my dad. He and Liz were ostracized by the tribe, and that hurt so much. They needed family and support, and they didn't have any." The experience made her father angry, angry at the world. Andrew, Margie's husband, pointed out that Elizabeth was also deeply affected. "She was kind of paranoid," he said. Margie nodded and said, "Aunt Liz couldn't stay in one place and was always changing her address and phone number." Elizabeth showed little interest in seeing Ernest, who eventually moved into a mice-infested trailer just outside Osage County. But Cowboy occasionally visited. "I think a part of him longed for a father," Margie said. "But he knew what his father had done. He called him Old Dynamite." When Ernest died in 1986, he was cremated, and his ashes were given to Cowboy in a box. Ernest had left instructions with Cowboy to spread them around the Osage Hills. "Those ashes were in the house for days, just sitting there," Margie recalled. "Finally, one night, my dad got real mad and took the box and just chucked it over a bridge." During a break in the dancing, as the sun began its descent in the sky, Margie offered to show me around Gray Horse. The three of us got in her car, and she began driving down a narrow, dusty road. Not far from the pavilion, almost concealed amid the blackjacks, was one of the few houses standing in Gray Horse. "That's where I grew up," Margie said. To my surprise, it was a small, spare wooden house, more like a cabin than a mansion. The Great Depression had wiped out many Osage fortunes that had already been diminished by guardians and thieves. Margie said that Molly's was no exception. The price of a barrel of oil, which reached more than $3 during the boom years, plummeted to 65 cents in 1931, and an annual headright payment fell to less than $800. The following year, the Literary Digest published an article headlined, "Osage Oil Wealth Fading." It reported, "These Indians became accustomed to lives of glorious ease, but now their income from oil is rapidly disappearing, and that was practically all they had." Compounding the situation was the gradual depletion of the oil fields. In 1929, even before the stock market crash, a national newspaper story reported, "In 5 years, if the oil map continues to shift, the tribe may have to go back to work." Over the next few decades, most of the boom towns, including Gray Horse, began to die off. "When I was little, I could hear the oil wells pumping," Margie recalled. "Then one day, they stopped." Today, more than 10,000 wells remain scattered across the reservation, but they are generally what oil men call stripper wells, each one generating less than 15 barrels a day. When an auction for Osage oil leases was held in Tulsa in 2012, 3 leases sold for less than $15,000 in total. Margie, who inherited a little more than half of a headright from her father, still receives a quarterly check for her share in the mineral trust. The amount varies depending on the prices of oil, but in recent years has usually amounted to a few thousand dollars. "It certainly helps, but it's not enough to live on," she said. The Osage have found new sources of revenue, including from 7 casinos that have been built on their territory. They were formerly called the $1 Million Elm Casinos. They generate tens of millions of dollars for the Osage, helping to fund their government, educational programs, and health care benefits. The Osage were also able to retrieve at least a portion of the oil funds mismanaged over decades by the U.S. government. In 2011, after an 11-year legal battle, the government agreed to settle a lawsuit brought by the Osage for $380 million. As we drove through Gray Horse, we came upon a clearing in the woods where there was an old cemetery. We got out of the car, and Margie paused in front of a tombstone bearing Molly Burkhart's name. The epitaph said, "She was a kind and affectionate wife, and a fond mother and a friend to all." Nearby were the plots for Molly's murdered sisters and her murdered brother-in-law, Bill Smith, and her murdered mother, Lizzie, and her murdered first husband, Henry Roan. Margie looked around at the tombs and asked, "What kind of person could do this?" Margie had earlier laid flowers around the graves, and she bent down and straightened one. "I always try to decorate the stones," she said. We resumed driving and cut along a dirt road through the prairie. Lush, tall grasses spread as far as the eye could see, a rolling green expanse that was disturbed only by a few small rusted oil pumps and by cattle grazing here and there. Earlier, when I drove to Gray Horse, I'd been startled by the sight of bison roaming through the prairie with their bowed heads and massive woolly bodies supported seemingly impossibly on narrow legs. In the 19th century, bison were extinguished from the prairie, but in recent years they have been reintroduced by conservationists. The media mogul Ted Turner had been raising bison on a 40,000-acre ranch between Fairfax and Pawhuska, a ranch that in 2016 was bought by the Osage Nation. As Margie and her husband and I continued across the prairie, the sun floated above the rim of the earth, a perfect orange sphere that soon became half a sun, then a quarter, before dying off with a burst of dazzling light. Margie said, "I like it when the sky gets pink like this." We seemed to be driving aimlessly, riding up and down over the undulating land, like a ship adrift in the waves. Suddenly, at a peak, Margie jolted the car to a stop. In the distance was a ravine, and at the bottom, a meandering creek. "Over there, that's where they shot Anna," Margie said. My dad took me horseback riding and showed me the spot. I was young, and we only had our horses. It was kind of scary. In 2009, an Osage named Elise Passion published a poem called Wigia, which means prayer in Osage. Narrated from Molly Burkhart's point of view, the poem is about the murder of Anna Brown. "Because she died where the ravine falls into water. Because they dragged her down to the creek. In death she wore her blue broadcloth skirt. Though frost blanketed the grass, she cooled her feet in the spring. Because I turned the log with my foot. Her slippers floated downstream into the dam. Because after the thaw, the hunters discovered her body." The poem ends with these lines. "During Klaska Zinka Teve, the killer of the flower's moon, I will wade across the river of the blackfish, the otter, the beaver. I will climb the bank where the willow never dies." By the time Margie drove on, the prairie was shrouded in the dark of night. Only the beams from the headlights illuminated the dusty road. Margie said that her parents first told her what Ernest and Hale had done when she was a child. "I used to worry whenever I did something naughty. What if I'm the bad seed?" Margie recalled. She said that occasionally the FBI story would air on local television, and she and her family would watch it and cry. As she spoke, I realized that the reign of terror had ravaged, still ravaged, generations. A great-grandson of Henry Rowan's once spoke of the legacy of the murders. I think somewhere it is in the back of our minds. We may not realize it, but it is there, especially if it was a family member that was killed. You just have it in the back of your head that you don't trust anybody. We emerged from the prairie and headed into downtown Fairfax. Although still officially a town, it seemed on the verge of oblivion. Year by year, its population had shrunk. Now it was fewer than 1,400. The main street was lined with the Western-style buildings that had been constructed during the boom, but they were abandoned. We paused by the largest storefront, its window darkened with grime and cobwebs. "That was the Big Hill Trading Company," Margie said. "When I was growing up, it was still in business. It was huge, and had these great wooden banisters and old wood floors. Everything smelled of wood." I looked down the street, trying to envision what Molly Burkhart and Tom White had seen. The Pierce Arrow motor cars, and the cafes, and the oil men, and the aristocratic Osage. The wild furies that had once burned there. Now, even on a Saturday night, it was a ghost town, as Margie put it. She drove on again and turned off the main street into a small residential area. A few of the old mansions remained, but they were deserted and decaying. Some were completely imprisoned in vines. At one point, Margie slowed down, as if searching for something. "What are you looking for?" her husband asked. "The place where the house was blown up." "Isn't it back the other way?" he said. "No, it's... Ah, here it is," she said, pulling over by the lot where another house had since been built. Margie then mentioned something that I had not seen in any of the FBI records. Her father had told her that on the night of the explosion, he and his sister and Molly had been planning to spend the night at the Smith's house. But Cowboy had a bad earache, and they had stayed home. "That's why they escaped," Margie said. "It was just fate." It took a moment for the implication to sink in. "My dad had to live knowing that his father had tried to kill him," Margie said. For a while we sat in the car in the darkness, trying to comprehend what could not be comprehended even after all these years. Finally, Margie shifted into forward and said, "Well, why don't we go back to the dances?" 23. A Case Not Closed. History is a merciless judge. It lays bare our tragic blunders and foolish missteps, and exposes our most intimate secrets, wielding the power of hindsight like an arrogant detective who seems to know the end of the mystery from the outset. As I combed through the historical records, I could see what Molly could not see about her husband. An Osage had told me, "Who would believe that anyone would marry you and kill your family for your money?" I could see White unable to recognize Lawson's bogus confession or Hoover's sinister motives. And as I dug deeper into the Osage murder cases, into the murk of autopsies and witness testimony and probate records, I began to see certain holes in the Bureau's investigation. The authorities insisted that once Hale and his conspirators were given life sentences, they'd found the guilty parties. And after White had taken the job at Leavenworth, the cases were closed, closed with great triumph, even though the Bureau had not yet connected Hale to all 24 murders. Was he really responsible for every one of them? Who, for example, had abducted the oil man McBride in Washington, D.C., or thrown W.W. Vaughn off the speeding train? Hale relied on others to do his bloodletting, but there was no evidence that Hale's usual coterie of henchmen, including Brian Burkhart, Asa Kirby, John Ramsey, and Kelsey Morrison, had trailed McBride to the nation's capital or were with Vaughn on the train. Whoever had murdered these men had seemed to get away scot-free. I could not find any new leads on the McBride case. But one day, when I was doing research in Oklahoma City, I called Martha Vaughn, a granddaughter of W.W. Vaughn's. She was a social worker who lived in Salisaw, Oklahoma, which is 160 miles from the state capital. She was eager to talk about her grandfather and offered to drive to see me. "Let's meet at the Skirvin Hotel," she said. "It'll give you a glimpse of some of the riches that oil brought to Oklahoma." When I arrived at the hotel, I understood what she meant. Built in 1910 by the oil man W.B. Skirvin, it was once billed as the finest hotel in the Southwest, with a ballroom that seated 500 people and chandeliers imported from Austria and pillars topped with busts of Bacchus, the Greek god of wine. Hale's attorney, Sergeant Prentice Freeling, died, apparently of a cerebral hemorrhage, in one of the hotel rooms while playing solitaire. In 1988, amid a devastating oil downturn, the hotel closed and remained shuttered for years. But nearly two decades later, after undergoing a $55 million renovation, it reopened as part of the Hilton chain. I waited for Martha in the lobby, which still has the original arched wooden entryway and the faces of Bacchus peering down from the ceiling. When Martha arrived, she was accompanied by her cousin Melville Vaughn, a biology professor at the University of Central Oklahoma. "He knows a lot about Grandpa Vaughn," Martha said. Melville was carrying two thick binders, and as we sat at the bar, he laid them before me. They were filled with research that over decades the family had obsessively collected about W.W. Vaughn's murder. The binders included faded newspaper clippings, "Pawhuska Man's Nude Body Found," Vaughn's death certificate, and an informant statement to the FBI that Vaughn, shortly before being killed, had mentioned having collected sufficient evidence to put Bill Hale in the electric chair. Martha and Melville said that Vaughn's widow, Rosa, was left with 10 children to raise and no income. They had to move from their 2-story house into a storage garage. "They didn't have money to eat," Martha said. The Osage banded together and basically helped feed the family. Some of Vaughn's children, including Martha's father, went to live with Osage families, where they grew up speaking Osage and learning the traditional dances. "My father felt safe among the Osage," Martha said. She explained that though many members of her family believed that Hale had wanted Vaughn silenced, they suspected that there was more to the murder. They wondered who the assassin was and how the killing was carried out. Was Vaughn murdered before he was thrown off the train, or did the impact kill him? Someone with influence had made sure that the inquest was a sham. The cause of death was listed as unknown. For a while we discussed elements of the case. Melville explained that Vaughn was big and strong, which meant that the assassin had to have been physically powerful or helped by accomplices. Vaughn, I recalled, had told his wife that he had stashed evidence on the murders, as well as money for the family, in a secret hiding place. I asked Melville and Martha how the killer could have determined where this hiding place was. Martha said that there were only 2 possibilities. The killer either forced the information out of Vaughn before throwing him off the train, or the killer was someone whom Vaughn trusted enough to confide such information. Melville said that after Hale had gone to jail, a relative tried to continue investigating the case, but he received an anonymous threat that if he and the family pressed the matter any further, they'd all end up like W.W. Vaughn. After that, the family stopped digging. Martha said, "I remember talking to my oldest uncle. My sister and I were visiting with him before he died. We said, 'Who did this to Grandpa Vaughn?' He mentioned the warning to the family and said not to go there. He was still frightened." I asked if Rosa or anyone else in the family had ever mentioned any potential suspects besides Hale. "No," Martha said. "But there was a man who'd embezzled money from Grandpa Vaughn's estate after he died, and whom Rosa then sued in civil court. I asked what the man's name was, and Martha said, 'Something Burt.' Yes, H.G. Burt, Melville said. He was president of a bank. I wrote down the name in my notebook, and when I looked up, I could see the eagerness in their eyes. I suddenly feared that I'd stirred false hope. It's been a long time, I said, but I'll see what I can find.